Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. August tied July as the hottest month on record. Scientists believe that this year will be the hottest year ever recorded. And then on Friday, California ended its fifth consecutive year of drought. The Department of Water Resources says there's little hope that the trend will reverse. Raging wildfires are now the new norm in California. We did a show about this recently. A number of states across the country are experiencing devastating floods, tornadoes, wildfires, and other extreme events. But the political and public discourse does not seem to match what scientists are calling a climate crisis with devastating repercussions for humans and other species on Earth. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump has said that if he's elected, he will weaken the EPA, abolish President Obama's Clean Power Plan, promote fossil fuel exploration, and recruit oil and gas executives to lead his cabinet. The successful misinformation campaign by powerful climate deniers has confused the public and has hampered efforts to deal with the potentially irreversible and catastrophic impacts of climate change. Last week, during the first presidential debate, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump spent 1 minute and 22 seconds on the topics of climate change and other environmental issues. Environmental groups are hoping that this changes in the next two debates. And then we have 182 members of Congress who do not accept the scientific consensus on man-made climate change. With the increasing number of reports sounding the alarm, what will it take to change course? And where are we right now? Today we are joined by Noah Diffenbaugh, professor in the School of Earth, Energy, and Environmental Sciences and senior fellow at the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment. Noah Diffenbaugh's research interests are centered on the dynamics and impacts of climate variability and climate change, including the role of humans as a coupled component of the climate system. Hi, Noah. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks a lot.
So I just want to start off by asking you, if you do a search for oceans, mass extinction, deforestation, coral reefs, I mean, so much information pops up. The information is out there. Bill McKibben just wrote a piece for New Republic called Recalculating the Climate Math. The numbers on global warming are even scarier than we thought. And these articles are coming out on a regular basis. But do you think the public at large really understands what we're dealing with right now?
Well, I certainly think that we have seen a increasing recognition of the risks that are posed by continuing global warming, and we see that in the Paris Agreement that the United Nations agreed on in December, and that is now getting very close to coming into full force, full legal force. In terms of ratification, I think we're seeing that here in the U.S. Not only as is reflected in all the efforts that the current administration has made, but also I think certainly there's been a recognition, over the last decade that we are already experiencing impacts from the climate change that's already happened, and we certainly feel this in terms of extreme events, heat waves, heavy rainfall, extreme storm surge flooding. These are all have been increasing in the U.S. in the United States and are likely to continue to increase if global warming continues.
And you work on this issue full time. What are you concerned about most?
Well, we as I say, over the last decade, there's really been an explosion of our scientific understanding of extreme events and how global warming is influencing extreme events and how we're already experiencing impacts as a result. And certainly that's what I spend a lot of my time thinking about day to day, working on trying to understand scientifically. The big challenge is that, we're living in a world where not only do the top billion or so people enjoy tremendous access to energy resources, tremendous benefits from those energy resources, but that we have huge populations that don't benefit from that access to energy resources. And, you know, if you look at the, you know, the 1.5 billion people that don't have access to electricity, anywhere from 1 billion to 2 billion people that don't have access to clean water, depending on how you define clean water, the 2.5 billion people that rely on biomass for cooking and have all of the health effects that the negative health consequences that come from that. We have huge populations globally that really suffer from energy poverty. And so the big challenge is, you know, how do we simultaneously increase access to energy resources and decrease fossil fuel consumption and associated greenhouse gas emissions to both ensure access to the benefits of energy resources while also stabilizing the climate system. And that is a big challenge, and Paris lays out a pathway for achieving that. The window is open. Certainly the window is closing every year that we don't proceed along that pathway. But Paris was a really big moment in charting a pathway, and certainly we do have the opportunity to meet that challenge.
Let's talk about Paris since you brought it up. We did a show about this after it was ratified. This happened back in December. 195 countries negotiated over 2 weeks on this agreement. It requires countries to devise plans to achieve the goal of keeping the rise in temperatures within 2 degrees Celsius, or about 3.6 Fahrenheit. And just over the weekend, we got word that India ratified the Paris climate deal. So now we have 62 countries on board. When we did this show, the guest said it's important to point out that this is not a binding agreement, but a very, very important one. What is your overall assessment, and how significant is it that India just joined?
Well, it's significant both in terms of how the agreement is laid out, and it's significant from a in terms of really putting the rubber to the road in terms of the global ambition. So in terms of how the agreement is laid out, essentially the agreement comes into quote full force when thresholds of the percentage of countries and the percentage of global emissions ratify. And what I read this morning, after reading that news about India ratifying, is really that the European Union now can push the push the agreement over the line in terms of bringing it into full force. And we heard news last week that they were in the process of fast-tracking their commitment. So,
and what does that mean exactly, to fast-track the commitment?
Well, so I'm not an expert on international relations by any means, but the European Union is comprised of individual countries, and so you have an environment in which the countries are responsible for committing to what's in the Paris Agreement, and then you have the European Union as a collective of those countries. And so you'd have to talk to an expert on European policy and international relations to get the details. But essentially, if the countries that comprise the European Union all commit in the way that India just did this weekend, and that the U.S. and China announced recently that they would as well, then that would push the global community over the threshold of bringing the agreement into full force.
And what are your thoughts about what the United States is or is not doing? UC Berkeley's Jeffrey Greenblatt recently found that the U.S. will probably not meet its targets of cutting CO2 emissions. The U.S. pledged to reduce emissions by 26% to 28% by 2025. What are your thoughts? How do you assess where the U.S. is right now?
Well, so I think that, probably, certainly the most practical way to make that assessment for the U.S. or for the globe or for any other country within the world community is to look at what the trajectory, what the historical trajectory has been, and what direction and how fast are we headed in the future. And so, the trajectory has been increasing emissions year after year. So not even just continuing to emit greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, but actually globally increasing the annual emissions year on year. And we saw in 2015 a slight decline in emissions relative to 2014, and that was announced right during the Paris Agreement that the world was on track for that reduction. And in fact, it was the first year on record where global GDP increased and global fossil fuel CO2 emissions decreased. And so that was a really important benchmark. And really, any decline in the annual rate of emissions will be progress towards the Paris goals, and that's just the arithmetic. So really, it's Paris is really trying to turn a big ship around, right? Where we've if we stabilize emissions globally, we'll continue to have more global warming. In order to meet the Paris commitments, really, the globe has to reach net zero greenhouse gas emissions, and so the first step in heading to decarbonizing the economy, which is what's required by the Paris Agreement, the first step in that is reducing the increase in emissions.
And what were your thoughts on the news we got last week that carbon dioxide levels crossed 400 parts per million, which is a very important and alarming threshold, according to a lot of scientists? Carbon dioxide is the gas that's responsible for global warming. Do you think people, when they read this and they see 400 parts per million, they understand what this means?
Well, I think if, like most numbers, like 2 degrees Celsius and 400 parts per million and a lot of numbers that are published in the scientific literature, they don't mean much out of that context. Where 400 parts per million really means something is within the context of the long-term change. And there were the really groundbreaking measurements that were made by Keeling starting back in the late 1950s. And when Keeling started measuring carbon dioxide concentrations at Mauna Loa in Hawaii, the measurements he was getting were a little under 320 parts per million. And so we've gone, in half a century, we've gone from 320 parts per million up to 400 parts per million. So that context means a lot more. If we look back further in time, scientists can extract gas bubbles from ice, say in Antarctica or in Greenland. And what we know from decades of research looking at ice cores, we know that the carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere varied between about 180 parts per million and 280 parts per million for hundreds of thousands of years prior to the Industrial Revolution. So within that context, we have a little bit more of a benchmark to evaluate what does 400 parts per million mean.
Well, I'd love to hear listeners weigh in on this. Do you understand what we're facing? We get a lot of articles. We do a lot of shows about everything from ocean acidification to species extinction to deforestation in the Amazon. There's just so much to talk about, so much news coming out. What are your thoughts on connecting the dots? Do you understand what we're truly facing today? And this is unfortunately not really a big part of the presidential campaign. What are your thoughts on that? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Yes, we're still facing a drought here in California. In fact, on Friday, California ended its fifth consecutive year of drought. The Department of Water Resources says this trend probably will not reverse. This is our new norm. And we just did a show about wildfires about a month ago, and we spoke with people saying, yes, these massive fires that we're seeing now are definitely the new norm in California. So what questions do you have for our guests about climate change, what we are facing, what we need to do to tackle it? I'll also ask Noah, and I'm about to introduce Michael Mann, about President Obama's environmental record. Noah Diffenbaugh is professor in the School of Earth, Energy, and Environmental Sciences and senior fellow at the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment. And now I would like to welcome Michael Mann to the show. Michael is professor of atmospheric science at Pennsylvania State University and author of the book, The Madhouse Effect: How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. It's great to be with you.
It's great to have you. So, Michael, when you take a look at everything we're dealing with, so many articles are coming out on a regular basis. Do you think the public truly understands all of this?
Well, at some level, the polling suggests that, by and large, the public does understand. Anywhere between 70 to 80% of the public in most polling that has been done over the last year or two recognizes that climate change is happening and that there is something unusual about it. And that's despite the fact that there has been a very concerted effort, an industry-funded disinformation campaign, fossil fuel interests and those who advocate for them, to try to confuse the public about what the science has to say. It's difficult to tell somebody something isn't happening when they can see it with their own two eyes. And I think that's the difference, and that's what we're seeing now. People recognize, whether in California and we're dealing with a drought that the paleoclimate folks tell us is probably the worst drought in at least 1,200 years, or if you're in just about any other part of the country and you've been hearing about 1,000-year floods, how many of these so-called 1,000-year floods have we heard about over the last half year or so? These are floods that shouldn't happen more often than once in 1,000 years, and they're happening, again, half a dozen just in the space of less than a year. Louisiana most recently, but, of course, Phoenix and West Virginia and South Carolina. We are seeing the loading of the random dice of weather by climate change towards these more extreme events. We've seen the most intense hurricane on record in both the southern hemisphere and the northern hemisphere within the last year. People are witnessing the effects of climate change with their own two eyes. The impacts of climate change are no longer subtle, and I think that's the difference. It's very difficult to fool people about something that they can see and experience themselves.
Right. Noah, what about that? How do you think this changes the conversation, the fact that so many of us are dealing with this on a personal level?
Well, I started graduate school back in 2000, and at that point, it was clear that global warming was happening. It was clear that humans were the primary cause of that global warming. But the science of understanding the extent to which that global warming was already having impacts was really just beginning. And what we've seen over the last 15 years or so is that we now have very strong evidence that we're already experiencing increased risk from the global warming that's already happened. So it's not, it's no longer a discussion of how do we choose to think about the next 100 years. It's really here and now, and that's something that's very clear from the scientific evidence. And I think that as Mike pointed out, that as people are experiencing those impacts on a year-to-year basis, that as with any sort of risk, that the more one experiences it, the closer to home it hits.
Well, let's take a few calls before break. Let's go to Mark in San Francisco. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you. I have a political question, which is what amount of power and what role can the American American president play in this? And what do the guests see as a Hillary Clinton presidency? What are her feelings about it if they know anything.
All right. Well, thank you. Yeah, I wanted to ask both of you, actually, what major changes did you see when George W. Bush left office and Barack Obama came into office? I remember being in a national park maybe 6 months after President Obama was elected, and I asked a ranger what changes she saw, and she said, well, we're actually allowed to talk about climate change. She said, under George W. Bush, we weren't allowed to even mention those words, and now we are, which is a major, major difference. Michael Mann, what would you say? What stood out for you?
Yeah, well, you know, the difference is that we had in President Barack Obama a president who accepted what the scientists had been saying for years, that climate change is real, it's caused by human activity, it's already a problem, it's going to be an even worse problem if we don't do something about it. And he, especially in his second term, used pretty much lever arm, pretty much every lever available to the president to try to act on this problem. In the absence of any congressional action, what we really need is a price on carbon, a climate, an energy bill that will put a price on carbon and level the energy marketplace so renewable energy can compete fairly against fossil fuel energy. But in the absence of that, he's used executive actions, the EPA, to tighten fuel efficiency standards for automobiles, to introduce the Clean Power Plan to make substantial reductions in carbon emissions from power generation, and, of course, engaging in diplomacy, where we had a monumental agreement between the U.S. and China a year ago to make substantial reductions of the two largest emitters of carbon on the face of the planet, made substantial commitments to reducing carbon emissions in the years ahead. That set the stage then for an extremely successful summit in Paris last December, where nearly 200 nations from around the world agreed to make substantial reductions in carbon emissions. So we've gotten on the right path. We're not yet on a path where we will stabilize warming below dangerous levels. There's still a lot more work to be done. But here's the key point, and I actually have a commentary today at the Huffington Post about the presidency and the implications that it has for this issue and whether we act on climate. It's called Donald Trump Really Is a Threat to the Planet. And what I mean by that is that we have to decide whether we are going to build on the substantial progress that has been made under the Obama administration and continue down that path, or whether we are going to sacrifice all the progress that has been made, retrench back into the fossil age, while the rest of the world moves ahead, by electing a president who denies that climate change is even real, and certainly won't act to continue the legacy that has been put forward by the current administration. So we could not have a more stark choice before us when it comes to the issue of climate change in this next election.
And we'll talk about Hillary Clinton after the break, but Donald Trump has said that he will weaken the EPA, abolish Obama's Clean Power Plan, promote fossil fuel exploration, recruit oil and gas executives to lead his cabinet. What else, Michael?
Well, you know, he has said that he would nominate a person named Myron Ebell from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, essentially a fossil fuel front organization. He would nominate him to lead the EPA transition team. And it's literally the fox guarding the hen house. And, you know, that signifies really a disdain on the part of Donald Trump for what the science has to say, a rejection of good faith efforts to deal with the problem of climate change. Hillary Clinton, of course, offers a different path. And whether one wants to quibble with all of the policy details she has put forward, it's clear that she embraces the fact that climate change is an existential threat. She wants to continue to build on the progress that's been made under the Obama administration and will lead us forward and will engage in the sort of global diplomacy necessary to achieve the reductions in global carbon emissions necessary to avert a climate catastrophe.
Donald Trump also says he would quote, cancel the Paris Agreement. That is Michael Mann, professor of atmospheric science at Pennsylvania State and author of The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. 182 members of Congress do not accept the scientific consensus on man-made climate change. Michael, are they all Republican?
Well, unfortunately, they just about all are now. And that's not because Republicans are intrinsically bad on this issue. Let's remember that it was under Republican administrations that we got the Clean Air Act, that we acted on ozone depletion through the Montreal Protocol. Nixon, Reagan, Bush Jr., and Sr. There was substantial progress made under those administrations, but things began to change during the George W. Bush administration, after he had initially appointed Christine Todd Whitman as the head of the EPA, somebody who recognized that climate change was a problem, wanted to act on it. Then Dick Cheney and his henchmen came in, working with the very same individual, Myron Ebell, of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, to subvert what had initially been a path taken by the George W. Bush administration to act on climate. So ever since then, the issue has become ever more partisan, and part because of dark money, folks like the Koch brothers who have literally targeted Republicans who express an enlightened view on climate change with a primary challenge. Folks like Bob Inglis, a congressman from South Carolina who had a near-perfect lifetime conservative voting record, but he made the mistake of speaking out about climate change, which he saw as a matter of, he's an evangelical Christian, a matter of stewardship, acting to preserve creation. He spoke out about climate change, and as a result, he faced a primary challenge funded by the Koch brothers to get him out of Congress. And there's been an effort to literally purify the Republican Party when it comes to the issue of climate change denialism because of bad faith actors like the Koch brothers and other conservative funders. And it's such a shame that it has become a political partisan issue where not so long ago it wasn't one. And there are still many conservatives, Republicans who are in office today, who understand what the science has to say, would like to act on climate change, but they're afraid to do so because of the threat of the same sort of challenges that other Republicans who have spoken out about climate have faced. And what may happen, we'll have to see. In November, if we have, depending on how the election turns out, it's possible we'll have a new political environment where some of those so-called in-the-closet Republicans, Republicans who do care about climate change but have been afraid to speak out, maybe, depending on how this election plays out, they will feel that there is now space for them to reassert their role in this discussion. We'll just have to wait and see. And again, if we don't vote, and if we don't vote climate in this next election, it's unlikely that we will create the space for those enlightened in-the-closet conservatives to come back out of the closet and join the discussion.
Michael Mann is author of The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. We're also joined by Noah Diffenbaugh, professor in the School of Earth, Energy, and Environmental Sciences, and senior fellow at the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment. Today, we are talking about climate change. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, local public radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may leave a comment at yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11 o'clock, it's Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, what America is like after the gutting of the Voting Rights Act. Stay tuned.
The This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll speak with Guardian correspondent Gary Young about his new book, Another Day in the Death of America. On an average day here in the U.S., 7 children and teens are killed by guns. Gary tells the stories of young people who were killed by guns on November 23rd, 2013. It's an amazing book. I hope you can tune in for that conversation tomorrow. We're also putting shows together this week about the new documentary Command and Control. We're going to have a conversation about presenting Black history in museums. There's a new museum in Washington, D.C. And on Thursday, during our special 11 o'clock hour, focusing on the election, we'll have a conversation with San Francisco Supervisor Scott Wiener, who is hoping to become the next state senator, taking Mark Leno's seat from San Francisco. So if you have any questions for Supervisor Scott Wiener, email feedback@yourcallradio.org. That is Thursday at 11. Today, we are talking about climate change. We talk about this regularly. So many headlines are out about August tying July as the hottest month on record, ocean acidification, the 6th mass extinction, deforestation in the Amazon. The list goes on and on. What are your thoughts on this? Do you think that, I mean, when you talk with friends and family and colleagues, do people understand what we're really facing? What changes would you like to see? Hopefully these issues will get more attention in the coming presidential debates. And if you have any questions for our guests about the action the U.S. is taking or not taking, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Michael Mann is professor of atmospheric science at Penn State University and author of The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. 182 members of Congress, almost all Republicans, do not accept the scientific consensus on man-made climate change. Noah Diffenbaugh is president, professor in the School of Earth, Energy, and Environmental Sciences, and senior fellow at the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment. Noah, before we go to our next caller, what are your thoughts on President Obama's record on these issues?
Well, I think we've seen an enormous amount of progress over the last 8 years during President Obama's term. You know, certainly the emphasis initially was on the UN process and the Copenhagen process, which was Paris before there was Paris, so back in 2009, and you know it's interesting to you know talk about this in class with my undergraduates here at Stanford, you know, for whom 8 years is a large fraction of their life, but you know in the history of America, 8 years is pretty short, and you know it's easy to forget that cap and trade passed the House of Representatives and then did not pass the Senate, but Waxman-Markey, you know, did pass the House in the lead up to the Copenhagen process. So that was a very different congressional legislative environment than what we face now. And so, you know, I think President Obama, you know, has very successfully pivoted, I guess, is the word that they use in Washington. You know, with the failure of the Congress to pass the carbon pricing policy, to use the executive powers to help to improve efficiency in terms of energy efficiency, and then we have the Clean Power Plan now, and then also a lot of different ways in which the executive has helped to improve resilience and preparation for climate change impacts in terms of all of the, you know, the national parks and the federal lands and all of those areas where the executive branch is responsible. So I think we've seen a lot of progress over the last 8 years, and you know, as we discussed earlier, you know, there really is a stark contrast between what the candidates are saying about their plans for climate change and more broadly the environment should they be elected. And you know, as a scientist, you know, one way to think about this is just what's the scientific content of what the candidates are saying. And the Associated Press did a really interesting exercise back in the fall, so last November of 2015, and they did a blind survey of climate experts where they took statements from the presidential candidates. At this point, there were, you know, this is last November, so there were multiple Democratic candidates, multiple Republican candidates, and they stripped off all the names of the candidates from the statements. They randomized assignments of different statements to different climate experts. They tried to do a random test, a blind screening, basically, and asked the scientists to grade the statements as if they were grading an exam, essentially. And of all those candidates, Hillary Clinton had the highest score. She had a 94. And Donald Trump had a 15. And again, that was a blind. No one knew who'd made the statements. They were randomly assigned to different scientists to evaluate. So I think that really highlights the difference, just in terms of the understanding, the understanding of what we know about climate change is very, very different between the two major candidates that are running for president now.
Yes, as a professor, that is a major, major difference. Clinton at 94, Trump at 15. Michael Mann talked a little bit about the differences. Noah, what else would you tell us about Hillary Clinton's policies, since this isn't getting that much attention in the presidential campaign? Inside Climate News has a piece saying that Clinton, though not committed to a swift transition away from fossil fuels, vows to build on the policies of the Obama administration and live up to the commitments of the Paris Accord.
Yeah, so what I've seen from Secretary Clinton's statements, she's one, very committed to meeting the commitments of the Paris Accord. She's very committed to meeting the commitments of the Clean Power Plan, which is the domestic version of that really is the mechanism for meeting the U.S. commitments to Paris. She's very committed to a clean energy innovation and job creation agenda with solar and other alternative energy, not only helping to decarbonize the economy, but also creating new jobs and well-paying jobs. And so I think that she really recognizes that we have a lot of ways to benefit in the present from investing in clean energy and resilience to climate change, and that those are win-wins that will also benefit us in the future. I mean, I think the reality is that we're really incurring a lot of costs from global warming right now, right? I mean, we this summer there are estimates that potentially we have six climate and weather disasters that will end up reaching the $1 billion threshold. That's a lot for one summer. And a number of others that don't reach that $1 billion threshold but are still tremendously costly and impact people and ecosystems in very profound ways. And so we're already paying out because global warming has increased the odds of those events. It's increased the severity of those events when they happen. We're already paying out for the global warming that's already happened. And so there are a lot of opportunities to better prepare right now, and at the same time, those investments will help us in the future.
Well, all right. Well, thank you again for calling in. Let's go to our next caller, GS in San Leandro. Hi, GS.
Good morning. Hello, and thank you so much. Madhouse effect. I love that. My question is related to the oblivious nature of the drivers. I haven't had a car since 2006. That's my choice. But I don't think most people can think like that. Drivers drive their cars. We've had our cars for a long, long time. They were a great invention. They give people freedom, mobility. It's hard to take that away. So my point is, I guess, that I think drivers, just as a representative population, need to be given an alternative, a serious alternative. Obviously, electric cars are out there, but they're not, the batteries are insufficient. So anyway, I would like to see serious increase in funding for battery research technology. We understand, can't have the government come down and say, oh, well, everybody should buy Tesla cars, but at least the government could work toward doubling the energy storage capacity. And then finally, I'd love to see a massive increase in funding for high-speed transit, increase in bike paths and so forth.
Yep.
And mainly, my point is, give people an alternative, a real alternative, so they don't have to be oblivious and, oh, I've got to have a car, I've got to get to work. Well, give them alternative ways to get to work and alternative ways to power their vehicle.
Well,
thank you,
GS. We think about this and talk about this constantly. If you live in the Bay Area, you know that it's never been this bad. So many people on the highways, and I look around, and it's usually one person in each car. Michael, what about this? I mean, trying to increase funding for public transportation and the kind of research that GS is talking about is also not really getting much attention in this presidential campaign.
Yeah, well, and here, you know, there is a role for the market. It isn't just government. We do need incentives from the government to do basic research and development on, you know, improved battery technology and alternative fuel pathways. And basically, we need to be researching every possible means of reducing carbon emissions from transportation. But you know, you look at what, you know, a great Californian, Elon Musk, is doing almost single-handedly. It's pretty remarkable, both through Tesla, but also Solar City with solar panels, and, of course, now with the battery technology that they are developing, which does promise to revolutionize, you know, electric vehicles and other platforms for storing renewable energy. One of the limitations in sort of running, you know, the power sector off renewable energy in the past has been the so-called intermittency, the fact that the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. But the fact is that there is a lot of technology that's being brought to bear, including battery technology, which is essentially solving that problem. The intermittency problem is being solved, and in part due to the revolutionary work being done by, you know, folks like Elon Musk in the private sector. And to solve this problem, to solve the transportation problem, to basically decarbonize the transportation sector, which is the second largest sector of carbon emissions in our economy, the obvious solution is electric vehicles with long-lasting batteries, which are charged from by a grid that is powered by renewable energy. If we can do that, then we solve that problem. And there is a lot of progress that's being made. I think that's really the path forward. Now, that doesn't solve every transportation-related problem. There's still a challenge when it comes to air transportation. But as far as, you know, automobile transportation, that is a revolution that's already underway, which really promises to greatly reduce the carbon emissions from our transportation sector. Now, we need to incentivize that process. We need to provide incentives for industry to continue to develop and innovate, but we need to be willing to scale up these technologies. The solution exists. You know, we don't need, as Bill Gates and others sometimes say, we need a miracle. We don't need a miracle. The miracle's already there. We just need to incentivize the technology that already exists. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't lots of things that we can do in our everyday lives to try to voluntarily reduce our carbon footprint, whether it's using public transportation. There's so many things that we can do that save us money, they make us healthier, and they reduce our carbon emissions. So why in the heck wouldn't we be doing those things? And that can go a long way to helping solve the problem. But ultimately, to really solve this problem, we need incentives, government incentives, to help the market move in the direction it's already moving, towards a renewable energy-powered grid, which we can use to charge electric vehicles and stop burning carbon for transportation.
And if you live in Alameda, Contra Costa, or San Francisco counties, Measure RR is a $3.5 billion bond to upgrade BART's infrastructure. We did a segment about this a couple of weeks ago. If you go to yourcallradio.org and just search for Measure RR, you can find that conversation. Thank you for calling GS. Go ahead, Noah.
Yeah, well, I would add that California has been a real leader, as Mike said, and it's been a lot of that's been private sector innovation. A lot of it's been partnership with the public. And at the national level, the Obama administration has done a lot in that regard as well. And Stephen Chu was Secretary of Energy in the Obama administration previously, is now back on the faculty at Stanford, and he really did a lot with batteries, and to the point that your caller mentioned. I think the other aspect of this to keep in mind is that climate is global, and greenhouse gases don't know about national boundaries. And a key element, for meeting the global goals set out in Paris is going to be that deployment that Mike mentioned. And, the analogy that's often used is cell phones. So much of the world skipped landlines and went from having no phones to having cell phones, and skipped that pathway of no phone to landline to cell phone that the U.S. and Europe went through. And that analogy is pretty apropos for energy technology as well, that if we have, the 3 billion or so people that, are essentially not relying on fossil fuels in a very intense way, if they go through that same development pathway that we took here in the U.S., we're going to have a lot of climate change. There's really no getting around that in terms of basic arithmetic and the energy balance of the planet. If we can find a way to provide modern energy services in a low carbon fashion, then that'll be a win-win, and we'll that leapfrogging is a critical component to meeting the Paris goals. Hmm.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for calling in, GS. We have time for one more caller. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
I guess my concern is this. I'm listening to what your two guests are saying, and if I understand this, I think I have a fairly good grasp of what may be happening, although until these things happen to you immediately in where you're living, like some kind of storm or a 100 or 1,000-year drought or whatever, I don't know if people really understand how dire this really is. Now, if this is as dire as people are saying, I'm not convinced that the current economic systems, and political systems around the world are capable of making the kind of dramatic change that I think needs to be made. I don't think the market's going to solve this problem in time enough, because right now I'm hearing not just your guests but other scientists saying, look, even if we stopped emitting carbon dioxide right now, we would continue to see the effects of climate change for the next decades, all right? Who knows how long? So to me, it's a question of, hey, this is like, the Second World War, okay? Are we going to make a dramatic change and do this right now, or are we going to, just make these incremental changes hoping that we're going to be able to stave this off? I'm not convinced. Mm. I mean, so...
Let me tackle that.
Sure, Michael.
Yeah, the caller makes a fair point, and there are writers like Naomi Klein who have articulated this view. I have a different viewpoint, and I would actually draw upon the World War II mobilization example. That involved government. It didn't happen outside of government. It didn't happen outside of the market system. It happened through a partnership between industry and the government, changing the incentive structure so that we, produced, manufactured the goods that we needed to fight the war and to prevail in the war. And we prevailed. We incentivized that behavior. We mobilized the resources necessary to win that war. And now we're faced with a different war. But this war is with ourselves. It's with our it's against our profligate burning of fossil fuels. And once again, it's a matter of the government incentivizing the behavior necessary so that we mobilize the resources to prevail in this war as well, the war against climate change. Now, I would argue that that can be done within the framework of a market economy. The problem isn't, in my view, that we are operating within a market economy. The problem is that the rules are stacked right now, where fossil fuels continue to get tremendous subsidies, in, either direct or indirect, and incentives, and we don't have similar incentives for renewable energy. That's actually the reverse of what we need. After all, the burning of carbon, the burning of fossil fuels, is doing direct damage to the planet. And in order to level the playing field so that renewable energy can compete against fossil fuel energy, we need to build in that damage estimate into the economy. We need to put a price on carbon. What that does is it levels the playing field so that those energy technologies that are not destroying the planet, renewable energy, can compete fairly in the marketplace. So the problem isn't, in my view, the framework of a market economy. It's the fact that the incentives right now aren't correct. And, of course, there's been quite a bit done to change that at the state level. California certainly is leading the way, but also with the executive actions that have been brought to bear by President Obama. And we need to continue down those paths. And again, we need to be thinking about that as we vote in this next election.
And Noah, what are your thoughts? We have about a minute left.
Yeah, I guess I would echo that. Again, when I teach this, my freshman class here at Stanford, we see, in the U.S. an argument about, no policy. If we look at Congress, we see an argument about either having no policy or about using a market-based price on carbon, and that's the argument. The reality is that there are a bunch of options that we as a society choose in other situations, where we decide not to do things if we think that the risks are too high. So I think the fact that the argument is really between no intervention or a market-based intervention really frames where the discussion is at now. But certainly from the, if you believe in markets, then the externality should be internalized into the price of the good or service, which in this case is fossil fuels. And we haven't internalized those externalities. We're not paying the true price at the pump or at the light switch.
Well, we will definitely add this topic to our show list. I'd love to do a show about that. Noah Diffenbaugh is professor in the School of Earth, Energy, and Environmental Sciences and senior fellow at the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment. Michael Mann is professor of atmospheric science at Pennsylvania State University and author of The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. Michael and Noah, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Pleasure being with you both.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with The Guardian correspondent Gary Young about his new book, Another Day in the Death of America. On an average day in the United States, 7 children and teens are killed by guns. Gary Young argues that these everyday fatalities are simply a banal fact of death. He tells the stories of young people who were killed on November 23, 2013. Tweet your questions and comments to @YourCallRadio and join us live at 10 a.m. with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.